So what I wanted to do this morning is to, which I guess will become the afternoon before too long, is to tell you about the adventures my colleagues and I have had in trying to think about this beautiful idea of positional information that we'll hear more about from one of the originators tomorrow. And in some sense, take very simple versions of the idea seriously and see where various quantitative problems arise. And essentially what I'm going to suggest is that it's useful to take the idea of positional information and measure that information the way that Shannon taught us to, lo, these many years ago, in bits, and to ask how many bits are available, where do you get them, does it matter if you have more or less, and so on. And we'll see, I hope, that some interesting things happen along the way. So let me start by saying, okay, suppose I have an embryo in which I have some position X, I have the concentration of some primary morphogen that I'm interested in. And I mentioned that I'm going to take the simplest versions of these ideas. And in some cases, I know how to say all the same things in a more complicated case, and in some cases, I don't. And I'll try to let you know, but I'll always try to do the simplest version that I think makes sense. So you have some concentration profile, and then the idea, as you all know, is that you can create patterns in the embryo by having a threshold, and then as a result, for example, if this is a transcription factor, then the expression level of some gene will switch from on to off at some point, and you've begun the process of dividing the embryo up into pieces, famously the segments of the French flag. And of course, what stands in the background of any attempt to actually implement this is the idea that there really is some molecular process for which this molecule is the input, this molecule is the output. And if I were to look at the input-output relation, it would have some vaguely threshold form. And of course, we've heard a lot in the first couple of weeks of the workshop attempting to, of the now decades of efforts of trying to, you know, sort of go down to the mechanistic level where these events are actually happening and try and understand their logic and so on. I'd like for the moment to stay a little bit phenomenological. So if you take this picture seriously, well, sorry, I should say one more thing, which is that, well, of course, there can be more than one of these output molecules, and I don't think there's anything that says I don't think there's anything in the original scenario that says that there can only be one layer to this process, but okay, again, that's the sort of elaborations. In some sense, if I'm a cell sitting at this point, then my identity and, well, fate is has a technical meaning, so let me stay a little bit qualitative. You know, what I'm going to do in the subsequent development is determined by the fact that I'm expressing this gene at this level, and of course, if there are multiple such things, it's the whole combination of them that determines whom I'm going to be. And you all know that. So what's and the point of all this is that who you're going to be is supposed to be in relation to where you are in the embryo. And of course, you don't have any direct method for measuring position. So that's the basic idea, that the information about position will be carried by concentration. In this simplest version of the picture, you'll notice that position gets transformed into the concentration of the primary morphogen, which then gets transformed into the expression level of this output gene. And the important thing about the directions of all the arrows is that what this means is that if you want your identity to be expressed by the expression levels of these genes, and you want it to be appropriate in relation to position, you can't have any more information about position than you have about this concentration C. There's no other path. Okay. So, and I can put more outputs here, and actually, I can even let them interact with each other, and what I said remains true. Okay? The only way that this whole set of genes can tell you anything about where you are in the embryo is by virtue of the knowledge, as it were, that they gained through this intermediate, the primary morphogen. So this is always less than or equal. Yes? That's right. So that's the thing I didn't do. Then the argument I just made would not be true. Now go ahead. Yes? Right. So there's a more complicated version in which you allow the events that are occurring in each cell at position X to interact with the neighbors, and then it's still true that there's a bound, but it's more complicated to say exactly what it is. So basically the observation is the following. If I want the expression level of some collection of genes, actually this doesn't have anything to do with genes. I have some local variables in a pattern-forming system. And I want the values of those local variables to carry information about position. That can't come from nowhere, right? So in the problems that you used to work on, right? In some sense, it has to come from the boundaries. Still work on, maybe. Still, it has to come from the boundaries, right? The only way I know my absolute position is not just in relation to my neighbors, but ultimately I have to, you know, if I want to make a periodic pattern and I want it to be registered in the box, I have to know where the boundary is, okay? And that information has to propagate to me. It can't be created out of nothing. So now, why does this matter? It's true, but why does it matter? The reason it matters is because we know that in real biological systems, when you try to regulate the expression of the gene by changing the concentration or transcription factor, there's noise. And so this picture actually should have error bars on it. And those error bars are not your measurements. They're actually the noise in the system, which ultimately arises because the concentrations of these molecules are not terribly high and the total copy numbers are not that high. So, for example, suppose that you had a system like this, and I told you that if you measure the size of these error bars, so let's call that sigma g, and let's do what is often done, which is to plot the fractional variance, that is to say the standard deviation divided by the mean, and let's plot that versus the mean. As many of you know, the sort of naive expectation is that the noise arises just because you have your discrete counting of molecules, so variances should be proportional to the mean. The factor is sort of how many total independent events you have, and if that were true, then this plot would look something like this, and it would come down to some level. And a level that's not unreasonable in relation to the data that you see out there for many systems would be to say that, so this is basically saying that the variance is proportional to the mean. And if this is 0 and we normalize this to 1 for the maximal expression level, maybe this gets down to something like 10%. Right? So you're saying I can control gene expression with an accuracy of about 10%. So if this is your system and this is the noise level, then it turns out that the information that G can provide about the input C is less than about 2.3 bits. Okay. But basically, these fluctuations limit how much information you can transmit. And I'll do something that's related to the calculation that you need to get the actual number in a moment, but just that's the scale. So what does that mean? It means that if, and again, this is a bound, and this is a bound, so actually getting to this isn't so easy. So what's that saying? It's saying that, well, if you had one of these outputs, you might have enough information to distinguish, well, roughly four different pieces, right? 2 bits is 2 to the 2 is 4. And if you want to do more than that, well, of course, you could put in more of these readouts. You might say, well, I don't know, now I've got 2 of them, that gets me up to about 5 bits, 2 to the 5th is 32, I've been able to divide things in 32, surely that's enough. Of course, that isn't right, because you'll notice that out here, the fact that, well, you can look at it in either direction, in here they're both on, and if you think about sort of coming from this side, by the time I tell you that the solid line is on, the knowledge that the dashed line is also on doesn't tell you anything new. They're redundant with each other. So if you start adding sort of more thresholds, you might think you can multiply this number, but you can't because there's redundancy. And you might say, well, I don't know, embryos are special. Maybe this number is wrong. It, you know, it's measured somewhere else. So I could try to do something that would allow me to raise this bound. Well, for example, if you believe that this variance is arising basically because you're counting molecules, then if you want to change the variance by a factor of 2, then you better change the number of molecules by a factor of 2. And you can work out that, for example, if you wanted to double this, you'd have to increase the number of molecules by a factor of 25 or something like this. So it really is expensive to get more bits. Okay. So what, so that makes you think, well, if I want, you know, why do I want more bits? Well, I'd like to build a reasonably complicated pattern. I would like it to be the case that cells along this axis, in some sense, have a rich knowledge of where they are, and thus can do many distinguishable things reproducibly. So this, of course, raises a question of, well, how many different things do real cells do and how reproducibly do they do it? And that's a really good question about which perhaps we know less than we should. And I may say some things about the experimental situation in a bit, but let me try to stay with the theoretical questions for now. Let me take it as obvious that, for example, if I'm looking at the anterior-posterior axis of the fruit fly as it's developing, you know that there are some things like the cephalic furrow which can be positioned with an accuracy of roughly 1%. And if you imagine that that's typical, that is to say that in some sense everybody knows where they are to within 1% accuracy, That's a big if, right? You know that one thing could be positioned to 1% accuracy. Maybe everything could be positioned to 1% accuracy. Then, well, naively, you might think that you would then need log of 100 bits. That's not quite right. You need a little less than that. You certainly need more than one or two, okay? Five, six, something like that, in order to make the pattern.
They don't all have the sound from the original model, right? For example, relative to your sitar pair, that's perfect. So I can just think of it to specify position, specify the middle, and then everything else can be specified relative.
So, you still want it to be the case, well, do you want it to be the case that, so there's two questions here. One is, in some sense, an experimental question, which is, do cells have absolute positional knowledge or only relative positional knowledge? Okay. And then the other one is, suppose they did have absolute positional knowledge, can you somehow, in a sense, build it by in some relative way in which, in some sense, the first one of these or some combination of them provides you with one readout and then the other ones do something else? I think that second one doesn't necessarily go outside what I'm talking about. The first one, one has to be rather more careful about. Yes.
Mm-hmm. At some point, the fourth system that
So let me discuss the experimental situation. So what I mean, there's so let me make a general observation. The first general observation is that sort of if you stay in a mathematical world, then there there are inequalities, right? The problem is that you would like to have at one end of the string of inequalities an experimental number. Right? That says, yes, okay, this is a characteristic of some piece of the network that does the business, right? And then somewhere over here, there's an experimental number, and so by measuring this experimental number, I've told you something about this, and now you can ask, how hard is it to reproduce that number? The difficulty is that in trying to get the experimental number, you'd like to reason from something that happens far downstream. And these arguments are basically saying, no, you can't do that, and you're right. So for example, there's absolute, to speak specifically about the case of Drosophila, even if I told you that every cell along its length, along the length, knew exactly where it was, plus or minus one cell, that is not the statement that a local readout, a cell autonomous readout of some particular collection of genes carries that much information. Okay. There could always be something in between that makes the story more complicated. So you might ask, well, what do we know? Actually, this isn't such a bad place to make the transition. So it's an interesting experimental question here whether the flow of the talk would be more predictable with slides than on the blackboard, given what we've seen so far. But anyhow, it's okay. I guess the thing is with the blackboard, you don't know whether I had a plan, right? Whereas with the slides, Boris can ask what's on the next slide, and I have to show it. Anyhow. My view of this is that it's motivational. And motivations could turn out to be wrong. Okay? So I find this intriguing, that reasonable amounts of noise put fairly strict limits on how much information you can transmit, and that amount of information relative to the complexities of the patterns you see are not miles apart. And so that suggests that maybe squeezing as much information as you can out of a system that presumably is noisy because it has a limited number of molecules is something that's relevant for forming nice patterns in the embryo. This could be wrong, okay, for the reasons that we've just discussed. So, I mean, it's a motivation, it's not a proof, okay? So, all right, is that clear? I'm a theorist, right? Yes. Yes. Well, so you could. I mean, in some sense, what I would like to be able to say is that some argument like this tells you that a particular set of genes should carry a certain amount of information, and that's really hard to understand, and so we have a theoretical problem to work on. Okay, that's what I'd like to be able to do. So there's two reasons that can be wrong that lead you in completely different directions. One is to say, let me do it in the order that the questions were asked. One is to say, look, you can get it from somewhere else. Okay, you can do this and you can do that, and I don't mean to trivialize those suggestions, but the point is, if you stop at some point, there's always someplace else it could have come from. And so that means that if you don't have enough information at this point, don't worry, you can always get it somewhere else. There's another view that says, actually, information is much cheaper than you thought. There's a zillion redundant pathways. It's easy. There's lots of information floating around. Just pick some of it and you'll be fine. Okay. I actually tend to think that's just wrong, but it could be. Yes? It's sort of like the next slide question, but yeah. Yes. So, right.
So, which way is setting up that? Is this enough information to do
so
the cases, or is this not enough information to do the fly?
So, what I would like to have be true, and what I'm going to try and push it toward, is that there's actually quite a lot of information available at the level of the gap genes. Of course, not enough to do everything, but perhaps more than people thought. And that it's enough that asking what features of the network are essential for achieving that much information given the available noise levels is an interesting question. So I sort of want to, I want it to be just right. I don't want to say, oh, there's a fundamental paradox, I don't have enough information to make a fly. Then you could get it somewhere else argument is there's too much territory, right? So I'm going to try and convince you that there's actually quite a lot of information and what I would really like to do is to convince you that the question how do I build a network to squeeze as much information as possible out of a limited number of molecules is an interesting theoretical question, and the networks that emerge from that seem to have something to do with the real networks. And I'm trying to motivate that question. I could just stop and we can talk about that question, then we'd come back at the end, or I could do more motivation. Maybe just do that. Let me just go to that question. We'll come back to the experiments at the end. Okay, good. So what this was meant to do is to say, as I just said in answer to Boris's question, that there is a theoretical question. If I give you some transcriptional regulatory machinery, but I give you limited concentrations and limited numbers of all the molecules, how do I squeeze as much information out of that as I can? And that's a question we can put a box around, and then we can ask, does the answer have anything to do with what we actually see in the real system? And that's the theoretical question I want to talk about. So, and that question is a question that I've worked on with a former graduate student, Jasper Tkachuk, former postdoc Alexander Volchak, and my colleague Kurt Callen. And this is, I'm going to give you the setup of the problem and I'll tell you what we know about the answer. So in order to do this, let's actually make these expressions explicit. Let's start with one input and one output. So C is going to go to G. How much information does knowing G give you about C? Well, qualitatively, if this is the picture, then you know, there are these error bars, right? And the error bars can be translated along the x-axis. And so somehow, if you know that G is around here, you know that C is in this window, roughly speaking. And actually, at the moment, I'm going to even abstract away from space. I'm going to say that I'm a cell, and I might have encountered a concentration that's anywhere along here, right? Presumably because I was in a different place, but I don't even need to say that. Sorry. So this is, if I look at my gene expression level, I know that if I control the concentration, that level fluctuates experimentally, right? In many cells. And since there's a finite number of molecules, you know it has to. Now, exactly by how much it fluctuates, whether the fluctuations can be reduced by averaging with your neighbors, okay, those are all sensible questions. But it fluctuates. And as a result, you have some uncertainty about where you are. So what is information? Qualitatively, you're saying, well, the concentration could have been anywhere in this region. I know I'm in here, so I have to count how many distinguishable regions there are. And as many of you know, if I want to do this right, what I should do is, if I want to count how much information I can give, well, first of all, I have to tell you how variable the signal G is. And again, if you imagine the cells that were arrayed along here, if you pull one of them out at random, you'll find that the value of G is random. It comes from some probability distribution. And if you compute the entropy of that probability distribution, then what you're computing is, in a sense, the capacity of that signal G to carry information about anything. Of course, if G fluctuates in a way which is totally uncorrelated with C, then it doesn't carry any information about C, so this can't be the answer. What you have to do is to subtract, right? This is the entropy in general, and you have to subtract what you could think of as being the entropy associated with noise. That is to say, even if I fix the input C, there's still some entropy. And I can compute that like this. Right, so this is the entropy of the distribution when I know what C is, and I should subtract that But of course, I'm interested in knowing this on average, so I should average over the distribution of inputs. Now, and of course, P of G is just the average over the inputs. So let me note that these two pictures, A, B, where I give you the shape of the input-output relation and I tell you the size of the error bars, those things are really about this distribution, right? It says that if I fix the input concentration, there's some average value of G. That's what you plot when you plot the input-output relation. And for simplicity, let's assume the fluctuations are Gaussian. Then I'm telling you the size of the error bars. So this distribution is approximately Gaussian. And I've told you the mean and the variance in those pictures. Okay? This thing, on the other hand, is the distribution of inputs and is independent. So in order to ask yourself how much information you can transmit, well, you need to know the distribution of inputs. Just to make the point obvious, if these scales were not properly lined up and the distribution of inputs, that is to say, you know, pick a point at x on x at random, what's the value of C? If all of those values were clustered down here, you wouldn't transmit any information. And that's not because of the error bars, it's because you're not actually using the dynamic range of the system. Okay, similarly over here, and in a picture roughly like this, you might guess that the good thing to do would be to have the dynamic range of inputs straddle the center of the input-output relation. So the first thing you can do in trying to, so the input-output relation and the noise level go in here, and so in some sense, the fact that you have a limited number of molecules is sitting encoded in here somewhere. And we'll have to unpack that in just a moment. But given that you have a limited number of molecules, of course, you can adjust the distribution of inputs to try to match the characteristics of the regulatory element that you're looking at. So this is true of any communication channel. Yes?
What is a limited number of molecules? I'm trying to picture scale. What would you call maybe 1,000?
At the moment, it doesn't matter, actually. So for example, if you observe that the regulatory element that you're looking at has a noise level that saturates around 10%, that's presumably because there's 100 independent molecular events, roughly speaking. Okay. There's a large literature devoted to the details of this, but that's the rough intuition. The number of molecules available is setting the scale here. Okay, and we'll, as I say, we'll unpack that more in just a moment. So I can, one way to squeeze more out of a limited number of molecules is to take this as completely given and try and tweak the distribution of inputs. Now, in general, that's a hard problem mathematically. But there's a limit in which it's relatively simple, and that's if it turns out that the noise here is relatively small. And what does that mean? It means that the widths of these error bars are small compared to the overall dynamic range. Okay? And then in that case, you can actually proceed analytically and figure out what the how to match this distribution to the characteristics of this. And the result that you get is, so if we're at small noise, then what you discover is that the solution to this problem is of the form that the distribution of outputs should be inversely related to their noise level. So this says something which is completely comprehensible. If you're trying to transmit information, you should use your symbols in proportion to their reliability. Or as Tom Lehrer said, don't write naughty words on walls that you can't spell. Okay? Right? If you're going to make errors, don't use that symbol. Right? You are, after all, free to adjust which ones you use. If you do this, then you discover that the amount of information that you can transmit is just this. Okay. So you literally, you take the dynamic range of outputs, you break it into little pieces, each of which is of size sigma g, you count how many non-overlapping pieces there are, that's what this integral is, and then the information is the logarithm of that. That's not quite right, because sigma g is the standard deviation of a Gaussian, and if you move over by one standard deviation, things still overlap a little bit, so you lose a little bit of information. That's the answer. Okay? Now, and that's, for example, how you get this number. Okay? So, if this was the whole story, you'd say, well, all right, somebody has to tell you what sigma g is. But we know something about noise in these systems, and so we know that, well, I can always make sigma g smaller by having more molecules, but it happens in a particular way. So you might ask, is there anything left to adjust, given how many molecules I have, that can affect how much information is being transmitted? And the answer is yes, in this picture, right? The overall number of molecules is somehow setting this scale. Maybe the shape is determined just by the sort of simple physical rules. But there's also the shape of this input-output relationship. So maybe I can tinker with the shape of the input-output relationship to push more information to the system. And that'll get more interesting if, instead of just having the input-output relation for one thing, I actually have many of them and they start to interact with each other, because then by input-output relationship, I mean the whole network. Okay? So let's see how this is going to work. In order to do this, if the noise level and the input-output relationship are just totally independent variables, then there's nothing more you can say. But you sort of suspect that that's not true, because fundamentally, the noise arises because you're counting discrete molecular events. How much output you have is related to how many discrete molecular events you have. So what you might expect is that the variance that you see at the output of the system has one term in it, which is related to the mean, and there's some coefficient. Okay. And again, this is, if you want, the shot noise in making the molecules at the output. But then you realize that that's not the only thing that can happen. Of course, you don't just need to make molecules at the output. You need to have it be true that the number of molecules you make is sensitive to the concentration C. And in order for that to happen, the molecules whose concentration you're measuring when you write down C have to arrive at some target. So if they're a transcription factor, they have to actually bind to the DNA. And of course, they arrive at their target by some random process as well. And so there's another shot noise term that comes, in a sense, at the input to the system as the molecules arrive at their target. You can also think of it, if you want, as the concentration fluctuations in the neighborhood of the binding site. And how big is that? Well, again, it's shot noise, so its variance is going to be proportional to the mean, but this is noise at the input to the system. It's noise in C, and you have to propagate that noise through the input-output relationship. So what you're going to get is something proportional to C. Like that. Okay. So again, you have an effective variance in concentration, which is proportional to the concentration itself. And then that gets propagated through the input-output relationship in the usual way. So you'll notice that in the small noise approximation, the overall scale of the noise, which is again determined by the overall number of molecules, just produces, you know, if you multiply sigma g by 2, then you shift the information by one bit. So I can take out an overall scale And then you'll also notice that if g is measured between 0 and 1, then this has units of concentration. And so those are the natural units of concentration. And if you actually try to plug in numbers for real systems, this concentration is in the range of tens of nanomolar. There's a lot of uncertainties, somewhere between 1 and 100. But importantly, it's on the scale of the concentrations of real transcription factors, at least at the order of magnitude. And so that tells you that that sort of this whole discussion actually makes a certain amount of sense, that it's not going to be the case that one of these terms is guaranteed to be enormously much larger than the other. So if I use this as my units of concentration, then I can get rid of this altogether. And now you see that if I want to change how much information I transmit, I can change the shape of the input-output relationship. And as I change the shape of the input-output relationship, I can shift the relative importance of these terms and change the value of this integral. So what do you actually do? Well, let's consider. Very good. Right, so let's now say that C is limited to some range between 0 and Cmax. So you're right that it seems like I can reduce my noise by making the input-output relationship less steep. But that's just saying that the noise at the output of an amplifier goes down if I turn down the gain. On the other hand, you know that generally turning down, you know, you don't want to turn the gain down too far because you won't hear anything. So if my concentration is in some limited range and I don't make this steep enough, then the dynamic range of G won't be big enough, right? And so I won't actually be using the whole dynamic range. And so if I actually ask how much information I'm transmitting, it won't be as big as it can be. So in fact, the claim is that if you assume, for instance, that G bar of C looks something like this, you know, the traditional sigmoid, and I tell you that there's a Cmax, I can then adjust the value of K and the value of N to maximize this integral. And indeed, the answer is that you want to put your cutoff somewhere in the middle of your dynamic range. And the steepness should be, you know, correspond to a cooperativity of order 2, nothing terribly extreme. So this is not a terribly interesting problem. It's just a check. It's a sanity check, right? That you don't get driven off into some weird corner. For example, the problem you just described doesn't happen, right? You don't, you know, you look at this and you think, gosh, that's weird. I can make the noise level go down by making this slope small, so that's going to drive the whole problem off into some weird corner. No, the terms balance against each other when you do the integral. Okay? So one input and one output's not very interesting. What's more interesting is if you have one input and several outputs. So there's a C here, and then there's a G1 and a G2. And a G3 and so on. And so now what happens? Well, and let's stay within this parameterized form. Well, the answer depends on this value of Cmax. So it turns out that if I have very low Cmax, and remember, there's a natural unit, so low means something relative to the parameters. Then you maximize information transmission with redundant readouts. That is to say, if Cmax is small enough, then as you put more and more elements here to read out the signal, you might have thought, oh, okay, what I should do is space them out in some way so that I can make use of the whole dynamic range of inputs. That turns out not to be true. if the total concentration of inputs is small enough, the best thing to do, right? What that means is that total concentrations are small, your measurements are very noisy. And so the best thing to do is just make the same measurement over and over and over again on average. Okay? So one of the things that I like about this result is that it tells you something that you might not have expected, which is that complete redundancy can be optimal. Usually redundancy is held up as an example of deviations from optimality. If everything were optimized, you wouldn't have redundant copies of things. In this case, the thing you're optimizing is actually the thing which goes against the usual intuitive notion of redundancy. You're actually maximizing how much information you transmit, but there's a regime in which the optimal solution is, in fact, to be completely redundant. Of course, if you now have larger Cmax, then you recover what you might have guessed in the first place, which is that you should sort of tile the concentration axis or have a staggered collection of thresholds. As you allow yourself to make more stripes in your flag. Okay? And the theory tells you sort of what the relationships between these things should be. It's not too surprising. It tells you that roughly speaking, you should try to turn the next one on as soon as this one has finished turning on, roughly speaking, right? So, so what that says is that building a staggered collection of thresholds provides you with a way of squeezing as much information out as you can from some limited number of molecules. And just to be clear, the number of molecules is limited both because this number is sitting here and it's counting how many molecules there are output molecules there are at maximum. And this number is telling you that you have a maximum number of input molecules. But you realize that, as I said near the beginning, this isn't really a very good solution for transmitting information because of this problem of persistent redundancy. So, if this is gene number one and this is gene number two, then by the time gene number two is fully on, you already know that gene number one is fully on. So that isn't, although you're making lots of those molecules, they're not really telling you anything. So in some way, this is inefficient. Now, this is a problem which has an analog in neurobiology, actually. It was recognized surprisingly shortly after Shannon's original work by Horace Barlow in the 1950s, early 1960s. He pointed out that in the retina, where you have a limited number of ganglion cells, a limited number of cells in your optic nerve that transmit information from your eye to your brain, you have the problem that neighboring photoreceptors see almost the same signal and thus provide you with redundant data. And if you have a limited capacity to transmit information, you might want to do something about this. So what should you do? You should somehow decorrelate these signals. And the simplest way to do that, of course, just difference them, right? If I'm, in the extreme case, right, if you're looking at something relatively homogeneous, right, you don't need every single retinal ganglion cell to tell you that the wall's vaguely blue-gray, right? What you might, in particular, if you spent all of your capacity doing that, there's no way you would notice that the thing is textured, right? So what you want to do is to transmit local differences, which will preserve the texture despite the strongly correlated signal that all of the cells are getting. And in the retina, for reasons that go back to work in invertebrate retinas, where this is more literally true, that phenomenon is referred to as lateral inhibition. So if every cell which takes an input from a point not only transmits its signal, but also gives a piece of that signal with a negative sign to its neighbors, then the signals at the output of the network will be less correlated than they were at the input. So exactly, we have the same problem, and we expect that we'll get the same solution. That is to say, the way to relieve the redundancy here is to allow these target genes of the input to inhibit or repress one another. And the question is, can you turn that into an honest calculation? And the answer is almost. If you allow for arbitrary interactions here, then you have the problem, well, then it is true that the network can become multistable all by itself. Right? So for a single value of the input, there can be multiple values of the output. And then what you mean by information transmission becomes more subtle. So let's avoid that for the moment. We'll come back to it in a second. Let's agree that the network that we're going to build here has a feed-forward architecture. So it has no closed loops. Okay. This is not realistic, right? This wasn't realistic either. So we're trying to take steps toward getting more and more realistic. So first, we just sort of broadcast to everybody they don't talk to each other. Now we're going to let them talk to each other, but there are no closed loops. Then in that case, you can show that if the input is an activator for everybody, then indeed the solution which maximizes information transmission is one in which you have repression in the among the targets. There's a flip solution, right, in which this is a repressor and these guys mutually activate each other. Having these guys mutually activate each other and be activated by the input is not does not provide you with a local optimum of information transmission. If you assume that the arrows in here are positive, then their strengths will be driven to zero. And so this addition here turns this into something where one of them turns on, the other one turns on, and then it turns the other one off, and so on. And you can get more of these, right? And you can even get these coming back on. And the problem that, so that's nice, and in fact, you see things that start to look familiar. But there's an interesting point to be made about models and mechanisms. So as long as I have this picture, I think everybody suspects that what this means is something like this. And we can discuss details, that is to say, exactly how do you want to parameterize this curve, but you also suspect that that's not so important, and you're right. As soon as you have this picture, then you have to tell me what you mean by those two arrows converging on the same output. And there are different choices you could make, and they matter, which was a surprise to us. So for example, you could say, well, I have this, where do these intuitions come from? Something like this, presumably there's n binding sites, things bind cooperatively. When all of the sites are filled, things turn on, right? That's what's behind this sketch. So then you say, well, if I have two things converging, I have n1 binding sites for this thing and n2 binding sites for this thing. And then if they're all occupied, then the thing turns on, or maybe one of them is a repressor, so it's all of these occupied and all of those not occupied. And so I would get products of Hill functions. And you can do that, and you can go through this whole exercise, and you get an answer. But then you realize that that's not the only possibility, right? Another possibility, for example, is that the whole complex that's responsible, if this really is transcription, right, then The whole transcriptional complex has many binding sites, and it itself can be in two states. So, like, you know, if you think about R and T in hemoglobin or allosterin enzymes, you could say, well, I have this big thing, and it can be active or it can be inactive. And what happens is that elements bind, and they shift the equilibrium between being active and inactive. So this is the Monod-Wiman-Schoenjerov model. Okay, and if you use the Monod, I mean, you could of course have used that when there was only one input, but then you would discover that the optimal parameters of the Monod-Wiman-Schoenjerov model are such that they look exactly like the Hill function. However, when you have multiple inputs, you discover that if you have this Monod-Wiman-Schoenjerov picture, then the optima you get actually can have a qualitatively different structure. In fact, the question of whether things can come back on again at the same output can come back on again more than once is qualitatively different in the two model. So I'm not telling you that I know the right model, but I'm telling you that when we draw these pictures, even qualitative questions about what the network can do hinge on what really happens when these arrows converge. And that's either really exciting or really depressing, depending on your point of view. I at least found that surprising. Okay, so that's a result. So what are we doing? I told you that I wanted to do this problem of maximizing how much information is transmitted through the network with a fixed number, with a limited number of molecules. The way we implemented limited number of molecules was, I have a factor here, and I have a hard maximum on this concentration. You might have said, well, maybe you should have constrained the mean number of molecules. That doesn't make any difference. We can do one input and one output. That's not very interesting, but if you can't do that, you can't get anywhere. We can do one input and many outputs, not interacting, and then you get the staggered thresholds. That's nice. And then if you allow for interactions, the form of the interactions, which serves to maximize the information transmission, is the one that relieves the redundancy, which if the inputs are positive, these will be repressive. And now you start to see something that looks like networks that we've seen in real life. But of course, this is still a case where we have feed-forward interaction, so we don't actually have mutual repression. We just have repression. Yes? So what we haven't tried to do is to just optimize the function flat out. So what we've done is to take these parameterized models that float around in the literature and use those. And as I say, we found this divergence, and maybe you're right that the next logical thing to do then would be to say, okay, don't believe any of the parameterized models, just ask whether you can optimize the function itself. Yes. Yes. I agree. So let me say one thing about feedback, and then maybe I'll say a few words about experiments. So trying to do the problem with an arbitrary network here with whatever kind of feedback you want, as I say, just letting yourself loose on that problem is a little dangerous. So we stepped back and asked if we could do a baby version of the problem. And the baby version of the problem is that one, right? So it definitely has feedback. But of course, it can even be bistable. The same questions that arose here come up here, and we chose the Monod-Wiman-Schoenjerov formulation. I don't think it's critical for what I'm going to tell you next. But so what's interesting is that this problem also has the feature that we found here, that the answer really depends on the overall dynamic range of the inputs. So what do you think is going to happen? Well, by feeding back on yourself, one of the things you do is you take some of your output noise and put it back at your input, and that might be bad. On the other hand, by feeding back on yourself, if you feed back positively, you lengthen your integration time. And this term in the noise comes from molecules arriving at their target, and if you lengthen your integration time, you're counting for longer, and so this noise should go down. I mean, you can do a real calculation, right? Sketchy. So there are two things working against each other. Okay, one is you're bringing your noise back, the other is you're lengthening your integration time. I should have said this at the beginning. Another sort of gross simplification we're making is we're having this entire discussion in steady state, so there's no cost of lengthening your integration time. And again, that's not because you can't do it in the dynamic case, it's because you have to start somewhere. So what's interesting is that if you just think about self-activation, then you get a split here where at low values of the input dynamic range, the lengthening of the integration time helps more, and thus you're driven toward having a significant amount of self-activation. Whereas if the input concentrations are large, you don't have a noise problem, and you don't want to make a noise problem by feeding your noise back into yourself, so you should turn your self-activation off. Okay. However, if you allow for the possibility of self-repression, you then discover that at large input dynamic range, self-repression can actually help you transmit more information, basically for the opposites of all the reasons that it was problematic in the other case. So what you get is a scenario in which, as a function of Cmax, there's a dividing line, and out here, you should have self-activation, and here, you should have self-repression. And remember that now both the input molecule and the output molecule are acting as transcription factors, because this is controlling itself, as it was over here, and you have to decide not just what's the, you know, now the maximal concentration of the output molecule also is relevant. And as the maximal concentration of the output molecule becomes larger, then the problem of input noise becomes more serious. And so as you go this way, the self-activation becomes stronger and stronger. Of course, somewhere there's a boundary where if the self-activation got to be too strong, the system would become bistable. And then at that point, actually, you lose information about your input. And so what actually happens is that if you go far in this direction, the self-activation is driven to be stronger and stronger and stronger so that it lengthens the integration time, but never quite crosses into the regime of being bistable. And so in fact, if you go this way, you would be driven somewhere out here toward some sort of critical setting of the parameters where you're just on the threshold of being bistable. So we think that we sort of have some control over these calculations now, and we're just at the point where we feel like it might be safe to try to put all the elements together and allow for interactions with loops and so on. And we think we know qualitatively what kinds of things we should get. The question is whether quantitatively you're going to get out networks that look anything like the real ones. So what I hope to have convinced you of here is that if you try, so the first observation is that realistic levels of noise limit the amount of information that can be transmitted in ways that are significant, right? So it's not like it's easy to get 10 bits of information. Getting a few already takes work. And if you build networks that optimize how much information you transmit, you can gradually, with a handful of readouts, get 5-6 bits of information. The things that you need to do include staggering your thresholds reducing your redundancy by mutual repression, and depending on where you are in parameter space, perhaps pushing yourself so that, if you want, sort of reverberation in the network is sustaining the signals for longer than they might have been sustained otherwise. And those are all sort of interesting things that happen to a greater or lesser extent in real systems. And what we would like to do is get to the point where we trust that we're doing a quantitative calculation. And we're almost there. So I don't know the answer to, you know, what happens if you let things loose with all possible interactions. Let me emphasize that, of course, there is not a single unique optimal network. There are many local optimal with different topologies. They have some things in common and so on. And I've told you about some of the possibilities. I should also say that as soon as you start allowing for interactions, the number of local optima that are approximately degenerate with each other actually becomes pretty substantial. And I view that as a good thing, because, of course, if we knew that the solution to this problem produced exactly one network, we would know that this is not a theory of real networks, right? Because there's more than one network out there. On the other hand, you know, there are themes to the kinds of networks that you see, like, for example, this business about about repression to reduce redundancy. And hopefully, there's even quantitative things that we can get out. Again, let me emphasize that if you take this seriously, it's not just that you qualitatively predict that, you know, this thing should be activated and then it should get repressed by this and so on, but you actually end up predicting, you know, where these points should be relative to one another on the concentration axis. The problem is that we've looked at relatively small networks. So, you know, one input, four outputs. It's already pretty sizable, right? There are tens of them, order 10. But we don't yet understand, I mean, 1, 2, 3 doesn't allow you to study scaling, right? So I don't know what happens if you have 6 elements, or if you have 2 inputs and 4 outputs, you know. So the number of possible topologies is growing very rapidly. The forcing you to be at a local optimum of information transmission is thinning out things. And it's hard from what we've been able to calculate so far to see how these are really playing off against each other. So while you're doing this, you might ask yourself, well, what are the sensible experimental questions that are motivated by this? So there are two. Basically, there's one at the beginning and one at the end. So you might ask, how much information are some set of genes actually carrying? And then at the other end, you might ask, suppose that I had a theory that produced, you know, a very particular output, said, look, this is what the network is supposed to be. How would you tell you were right? That is to say, how would you actually measure the strengths of these interactions? So let me make a quick remark about the last one, because I think the answer's easier, but also a little developed. And then I'll go back to the first one, which in a sense loops back to the beginning of the talk, and then I'll stop. So the answer to the second question, so suppose I tell you that I predict that if I have one input and four outputs, and there's some dynamic range of inputs that's limited, then one of the networks that optimizes information transmission is this one, with numbers associated with all of these arrows. And it looks qualitatively like the network in your favorite developmental system, or your favorite transcriptional control system more generally. But you'd like to know, well, do I really have the numbers right? So the traditional thing, of course, is to do things like knocking out components and asking whether things shift in the right way. Those are big perturbations, and there are perhaps limits to how quantitative one can be. There's another thing you can do, which of course is that if this is repressing that, and there's a fluctuation that causes a cell to have a slightly elevated level of this, then presumably it should have a slightly lower level of that. That is to say, your network architecture predicts, and in fact, since we're doing a calculation that has noise in it, you're predicting not only the average outputs, you're also predicting that the noises become correlated. And so if you can measure the correlations among the noise, you get another, I mean, in a network of n elements, in principle, you get another n choose two quantities to measure that allow you to perhaps disambiguate different models. And so what Julien Dupuis and in Thomas Greger's lab has been doing is trying to actually see this in antibody staining of the gap genes. And you realize that, I mean, this is perhaps not the ideal way to do it, you realize that there are all sorts of artifacts that could produce correlations in the noise, right? So it's not difficult to imagine that if I'm staining for two things, they both come out a little brighter. You can imagine how that happened. It's a little more difficult to figure out how you had an artifact that caused one of them to go up and one of them to go down cell by cell, right? That's a little harder, although not impossible until you have to do a certain amount of work. We've gotten to the point where I think we're convinced that, for example, if you look at Hunchback and Krupal, then in the neighborhood where they're doing this, right, if you sit at and look at populations of nuclei in a single embryo that are sitting in this neighborhood, you can actually see the anti-correlation in the expression level. And so we think that this is a path to gaining more information about the nature of the interactions without perturbing the system. Okay, so that's the, I should say, by the way, that the anti-correlations are astonishingly strong. So the noises in the two things are, you know, they have correlation coefficients 80-90%. And in the neighborhood where things are crossing, suggesting that there really is a very strong interaction between them. And actually, if you start looking a little more carefully, it suggests that things are in a very interesting parameter regime. That's not so easy to reproduce. Okay, so we don't have a result, or I would tell you you should ask Julien to give the talk, and he can do it. But we're encouraged that you can see interesting things, and so that this is a path to actually measuring numbers that go with these things. Okay, so that's one observation. So now let's cycle back to the beginning and ask about how much information is present. So again, this is an effort of Julien's. So Vincent, you can be happy that he's actually accomplishing something since you sent it to us. I guess you're his other advisor, so you should worry about this. So what he's been doing, which I think is very nice, is to say, well, let me look at this picture, right? So literally, let's go back to the beginning of the talk. And of course, if I look at many embryos, you know, you'll see, we've all seen these discussions, right? You'll see that for any profile, you have some fluctuations. So now you can ask, if I know that the expression level of, let's say, Hunchback is this, then I, of course, know that I'm in that region of X. And so by taking large numbers of profiles and measuring their variability, you can determine how much information one of the genes provides you about position. And so the first observation is if you do this for any of the gap genes, and let's restrict our attention to the middle 80% of the embryo, so we're not talking about what happens at the edges, you get something which is more nearly 2 bits than 1 bit. That is to say, some of the genes are, you know, 2.2 plus or minus 0.05, some of them are 1.7 plus or minus 0.07. Nobody is 1 bit, and, you know, things are shifted over near 2. So first of all, you might find that interesting in relation to our initial guess. The other thing you might find it interesting in relationship to is the usual view that the gap genes are defined borders. If they define borders, and that's all that matters, then they can't carry more than 1 bit of information, right? Because they define the region where things are high and the region where things are low. What this is telling you is that the graded expression in between is sufficiently reproducible that it also carries information about position. Whether the system uses that or not, you can't tell. Okay? But it's there. Well, what happens if you start to add up information from multiple gap genes? Well, you can't add it for the reason that I told you, they're redundant. So you actually have to go in and try and measure multiple things simultaneously. Measuring many things simultaneously is hard. If you make the approximation that the distribution at any one point, the distribution of the noise is Gaussian, then your job is easier because, of course, all you have to do is fill in the covariance matrix. And in principle, you can do that from large numbers of pairwise measurements. Although you have to believe that the measurements are sufficiently reproducible that you can merge them. And, okay, there's a long story for that, but we think we have this under control. And one way of expressing the answer is not in terms of the total number of bits, but in terms of this error bar on the x-axis. So for example, if I have just this profile and the variability looks something like that, then you would expect that if I look at the variability along the x-axis as a function of x, well, in here, things are pretty tightly defined. And so somewhere in the middle, I don't do so badly. By the time I'm out here, of course, I know absolutely nothing. Over here, I know absolutely nothing. And so I'm going to get something that looks like this. And in fact, by the time I'm up here, calling this an error bar is slightly weird. All I know is I'm in the back half somewhere, right? Now, as I start looking at more and more of the gap genes, combining them in pairs and then in triplets and finally all together, what happens is really quite extraordinary. By the time you put hunchback, giant, Krupel, and Knirps all together, this picture becomes essentially flat along the entire middle 80% of the embryo. And so what that tells you is that by reading the output of these four genes, you know where a cell is with an accuracy which is independent of its location. Furthermore, this accuracy is 1%. Now,
because they do start pretty hot and fuzzy and sharp.
So this is early in cycle 14, and it is very important that you not mix things from different time points, because of course things are shifting, and that will reduce. I mean, if you treat that as noise, then you've screwed everything up. On the other hand, the amount of information you have seems to not change very much if you go sort of 5 to 10 minute epoch by 5 to 10 minute epoch as best we can in doing them. So that's certainly a second order effect. You're right that I should be able to see something, but it's not, it doesn't jump out at you. What is true is that the mean profiles are different, and so if you try to merge them, you make a mess. But if you actually ask how much precision you have, that seems not to be varying so much.
I mean, the reason why I ask is because I understood from Steve Smart's work that it starts fairly broad and fuzzy mostly in response to the gradient, and then sharpens up, maybe that's a simplification, when the feedbacks and the lateral inhibition.
Given what I just told you, if I could show convincingly that when the lateral inhibition is absent, much less information is transmitted, I'd be very happy, right? I should even be able to calculate by how much. On the other hand, we don't see that clearly. Okay, so there's a little bit of evolution, but you know these measurements are a little noisy. I'm not sure that I trust this number. I think I trust it to a factor of 2, but not more than that. But if it moved by a factor of 2 systematically with time, that would be interesting, right? It doesn't move by an order of magnitude. So there are two observations to make here. One is that all the markers that we have in early development, like the cephalic furrow or the positions of peaks in the pair or troughs of expression, the pair rule genes and things like that, their accuracy is also in this range. So what this tells you is that the gap genes do in fact carry enough information to specify position with 1% accuracy. Again, that doesn't say that that's how it's done, right? It tells you they carry that much information. And that amount of information if you work it out, right? Again, it's not log of 100, it's a little smaller than that. But it's 5 or 6 bits. And so indeed, it's an amount that is not so easy to get out of networks that have the level of noise that you see in this system or other real system. And but one thing one might want to close with is to note that when we had one input and one output, if the noise was small, there was this very simple answer that you should arrange that in order to, if I tell you that the characteristics of the network that the signal is going through is fixed, or the characteristics of the, since one input and one output, the characteristics of that one regulatory element are fixed, then to maximize how much information you transmit, you should adjust your distribution of inputs until the distribution of outputs is inverse to the noise level. Okay. So a version of this argument that you may know is that if all of your output elements have the same noise level, then you should use them equally often. In image processing, this is called histogram equalization. Okay. Roughly speaking, the cells are arrayed along the length of the embryo at roughly constant density mid-range. So you have this information about position that gets encoded in the concentrations of things, and it goes through a network and everything else, and then you can read it out with some precision. If, as you try to transmit information through that network, you've matched the distributions of inputs to the signal and noise characteristics of the network, you would expect that you would get this kind of histogram equalization. And that's what you see. That is to say, the density of cells is approximately constant. That is to say, the probability distribution of X is approximately constant. And the error with which X can be read is also approximately constant. Okay. And so again, if you think about that in the context of X being encoded in the concentration of something, you have this network, if you do the generalization of this optimization problem, that's what you would predict. So it might be that the system really is tuned up to squeeze as much information out as possible. It's certainly representing more information than you might have guessed if you just thought about things being on and off. I should say that getting this result is not so simple. That is to say, this constancy, of course, is emerging from a picture which, as you all know, has lots of bumps and wiggles in it, right? So something happens with the shapes of the expression profiles and their noise levels and the correlations between the noise levels that, when you get to the end of the day, somehow makes this almost perfectly flat, which is striking. And so, since that's a phenomenological observation, maybe I'll stop there. Thanks. Yes?
You said everything is in steady state, but in principle, I can transmit information using time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It would be a different output of the second thing.
Yeah.
Right?
So yes.
The whole business that I can, the time for it.
The answer is yes. You know that in another life, I spent a lot of time thinking about how information gets transmitted in time. We just haven't gotten to it here yet. I mean, there are actually other people. So Ten Volde's group in Amsterdam has spent a fair bit of time thinking about information transmission and biochemical genetic networks dynamically. I should say there's a general problem. So this isn't just about genetic networks. The problem arises in neuroscience as well. If you want to talk about information transmission in a dynamic setting, it's really easy if the responses are linear. Okay. If you want to talk about information transmission in steady state, you can allow yourself arbitrary nonlinearities. It's no problem. You just have to do an integral. Doing an arbitrary combination of dynamics and nonlinearity and asking how much information is transmitted, no, I think it's basically just nobody knows how to do it. So you kind of sort of move around the problems that you know how to solve. That was a really big, I don't know. Maybe that's a good place to stop. Sorry, I don't want to. Somebody else is in charge.
Well, I mean, if information is really limited in itself, wouldn't it be the best way to store information in the network?
So, okay, yes. So, so we've done this discussion as if there is a signal that you're trying to encode, right? And so then, in that sense, so there's a limit, right, in which you have discrete attractors, and what the input signal is doing is just picking them, right? And for very small networks, that seems not to be the optimum. On the other hand, there must be a regime for large networks in which it is. What I don't know is whether that's true if you have a scalar input. I think if you have an input with a number of dimensions that's scaling with the size of the network, as in the neural network examples, then it must be that there's a regime in which that's the optimum. In this case, where the dimensionality input is less than in the case we're doing, which should not be confused with reality, right? It's an interesting question. Maybe the dimensionality inputs is actually much larger than we thought. We should think about it more carefully. Obviously the analogy has occurred to us, but that doesn't seem to be the optimum in this case.
Yes. Yeah, I was wondering whether you consider the nanosquake.
Simply because we had to start somewhere, we considered the case of one input. I'm embarrassed that this has taken us as long as it has. So you give me two inputs, it's going to get harder. Let me make one observation, however, about things coming from the other end. So, I told you that one of the problems of this staggered threshold solution is redundancy up here. And that can be relieved by mutual repression. So that makes sense. There's actually another problem, which is that even if you give yourself a fair bit of dynamic range here, all the solutions, so you might think, well, you know, I should fit more of these things into my dynamic range. But you don't. You fit them into the upper half. You sort of keep inserting them over here. And you can understand why. The signal over here is much more reliable. It's at high concentration. So you're left with this hole over here. And so one of the things we've been thinking about is, well, how do I make better use of the low end of my dynamic range? Well, I'm talking about a system in which I think I have a transcriptional activator. What I would love to have is something that allows me to change a sign. Right? I would like to take that low concentration and turn it into a high concentration so that I can use it more effectively, of something else so I can use it more effectively. So as you know, Bicoid happens to also be a translational repressor of caudal, and what we're trying to do is to understand whether, I can say the words, we're trying to do an honest calculation to convince ourselves that that actually makes sense. That is to say that you still have the problem that it's a low concentration, right? But since you've made lots of mRNA molecules locally, your readout of the Bicoid concentration is based on its binding to n different places as opposed to one place, or two places on the genome. And so we're trying to see whether that actually works, that by having your transcriptional in a scenario like generally, obviously we'd like to connect it to the embryo, but just more generally asking whether having transcriptional activators act as translational repressors gives you a way of making better use of the low end of your dynamic range, in some sense, for the same total number of molecules. So you have to ask, what do you hold fixed as you make this comparison? Yes? This discussion is sort of cell by cell. It's certainly the case that allowing things to diffuse can help because it can serve to average out noise. You obviously have the problem that you also become more like your neighbors, and so maybe you reduce your dynamic range. But in the context of models like this, there's a real trade-off, and you can figure out where you sit. I must say that going back to your first wine and cheese discussion, you know, I'm very intrigued by the possibility that the solutions push you in a direction where the lifetimes, the integration times of the network are much longer than the integration time, the lifetimes of the individual components, and therefore if they diffuse, they can diffuse much further, because that has other consequences. And so I'm intrigued that even if I think about things in a cell autonomous way, I may get pushed into a regime where if I add diffusion, it has the biggest possible effect. And that's how much I know. Yes. Yes. Proteins. Yes. Oh, yes, that's right. I have no idea where that information came from. In fact, I don't even know that it arose in a cell autonomous fashion. Just to be clear. Yes. It's the information that those four expression levels carry in one cell. Protein. Soon it'll be messaged and the measurement will be better. Yes. So it's only a question of whether we can measure it accurately enough that it becomes a useful input to the estimate of how strong that mutual repression is. Right, no. I'm not saying that we're anywhere near telling you that we made a theoretical prediction which is correct. Everybody knows there's repression. The question is, if you have a theory that predicts, you know, details of how strong it is, do you have any hope ever of measuring it? And so one launches one's experimentalist friends along that direction while you're calculating in the hopes that you'll meet someday. That's the only, right? And they're making progress and you can decide whether we are. I don't know. That's the correct statement. Thanks.